Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Karen Herman. She is the Director of Sexual Assault Services for the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, and she is founder and president of Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary. We're going to talk about both of these activities. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Thank you very much for having me here today.
It's my great pleasure. There's so much to talk about. Let's start with the first whole category of things, namely sexual violence. You have been studying both the roots of sexual violence, cultural differences in patterns of sexual violences, and what to do about the whole thing for some time. And I think it's worth starting out with the reality that here in the United States, it's been a very short time, maybe a generation, since the kind of going standard attitude toward sexual violence was blame the victim.
We've really come so far, Mary Charlotte, in the last 30 years. But if you think about the history of sexual violence, which has been going on since the beginning of time, that's really not a long time. Certainly, sexual violence was a major problem in the United States before 30 years ago, but it's really only been in the last 30 to 35 years we've had a widespread recognition of it as the problem that it is, the prevalence with which it occurs, the severe effects that it has on people.
And the understanding of that has come through basically very strong and powerful women's movements and the right crisis-centered types of movements and things like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. In the late 60s and early 70s, women really took the leading role in our culture here in the United States, standing up and saying that this is happening, it's wrong, it's happening far too frequently, we have to take action on it.
So the fact that that has happened, has that affected for the better the rates of sexual violence in this country, in this state?
What a great question. Here's the problem. Not having so many years of data on prevalence to go back and compare to, it's not really clear that our prevalence rates are so much different than they were in the 1970s. In the emerging research in the 1970s, the methodology, the funding, all of that just wasn't there. So we have better research today. It's very hard to go back and say we're higher or lower rates than we were in the 1970s.
Is there any kind of, okay, we don't have the rigorous data. Do we have anything that points us to a set of patterns and trends?
In terms of prevalence or
yeah.
just in terms of, what I can tell you is that the United States has one of the highest rates of sexual violence in the industrialized world, and that has appeared consistent for some time.
Now, why are we higher than France, Germany, Greece, whatever these other countries?
That's another great question, and we don't have a definitive answer. When you look at the history of the United States and what our states have been built on, while we have a rich and a very positive history in a lot of ways, a lot of our history also contains great violence, colonization, genocide, a lot of violence targeted against certain racial and ethnic groups as well as women. So
not to mention the environment and the creatures that live within
it. Other species, absolutely. And if you'd like to talk about cultures that are less violent than ours, we can talk about some of the traits. So one of the things that I've looked at in my research is not just that we have this very high prevalence of sexual violence in the United States, but what are the attributes of some of the cultures that don't have that? What makes them different? And there's a great set of research out by an anthropologist named Peggy Sanday, and she looked at 156 cultures over six regions of the world. And she found cultures that are so-called rape-free cultures, where literally sexual violence either does not exist or it's extremely minimal. And some of the attributes of those cultures are these. First of all, there's much more egalitarian relationships between women and men. And for example, that takes the form of shared governance between genders. Men's and women's roles are seen as complementary, not as in competition or that one is better than the other.
Now, does that mean they have separate roles?
They do have some differences in roles, absolutely, between the genders, but they're not seen as better or worse. They're just seen as complementary. Whether it be child rearing or working outside of the home or those kinds of things. The other thing that's interesting, which I'm hoping we can talk about later, and this ties into Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary, is that cultures that have lower rates of sexual violence than ours tend to have a much stronger connection with other species, with the natural world, and with natural cycles. And I think that's something that in our industrialized nation we've lost touch with, whether it's something as simple as natural sleep cycles or the seasons. And I think that's to our own detriment.
That's a very interesting correlation to make.
I think it's fascinating, and I think it shows us some of the ways that we can head towards, rather than just looking at prevalence or just looking at the harm done by sexual violence, which is all very important. However, we need a way out. We need a path towards making something better and different. And I think that these cultures provide a vision in some ways for that.
What are some of these cultures?
So, for example, some of them are in Europe. And some of the more indigenous cultures that have remained untouched by the so-called industrialized world, Samoa, Western Samoa, some of those places.
It's interesting. So that would point to, for example, the possibility that people who spend a lot of time growing their own gardens and raising animals are less likely to engage in sexual violence.
Very possible. Very possible. Closer connections to the earth and to other species.
Although that might... I don't know if that would include people who raise, for example, fighting dogs or roosters.
I would think that raising animals for violent means would not actually probably be positive in the sense that we're talking about.
So you studied all of this subject, and you wrote a dissertation on basically some of the ways in which people deal with sexual violence in the United States, particularly through entertainment and education.
Right. Entertainment education is a fairly new strategy globally, and it's not as widely used as the United States as it is used on other continents, such as the African continent. What it is it's basically using art in diverse forms to educate, to entertain, and engage people around challenging social issues and try to promote progressive social change. It's been used widely in Africa on issues such as HIV prevention, family planning, even sort of starting to touch on some women's issues such as education for women. In our media-saturated culture, I think it's a little more challenging to implement. However, I think it has a lot of potential.
So in Africa, let's hear some examples of what that actually looks like.
So in Tanzania, there are serious food shortages, and family planning isn't something that had been widely used. So in the late 80s and the early 90s, they implemented entertainment education using radio shows. And in a sense, it's storytelling via radio. And so if you think about Africa, you know, certainly people don't have television sets, and there might be one radio to a village. So people would gather around the radio to listen to the radio and listen to different, you know, media stories. And so they used storytelling with characters that evolved every week and incorporated themes around healthy family planning in that, and then information around actual family planning clinics that were available in different regions. And they found that there was a significant rise in use of family planning methods and in positive attitudes about them.
In another country, they used the same strategy to combat infant mortality due to diarrhea and lack of rehydration.
They did an amazing oral rehydration campaign in Egypt, and they found that they had a 70% reduction in infant mortality over, I think it was 5 or 8 years with this campaign. And when they went back and researched it, they found that 90% of mothers had gained knowledge from the campaign. It's
so
pretty remarkable.
This campaign is basically like a telenovela or a soap
exactly,
opera.
Exactly. It can take many forms. And in fact, they've used telenovelas in Mexico to promote literacy and job skill building. Very successfully.
So here in the United States, we live in a media-saturated culture. Right. So anything that comes... Although I have to say, I mean, I have certain kinds of anecdotal evidence about the successful, subversive nature of shows like The Simpsons in actually changing people's attitudes. Things that use humor, you know, not like...
Absolutely.
Some kind of didactic, depressing thing that you might find on the very high channels on your satellite dish.
Right. And the exciting thing, I think, about entertainment education is that it can make a very difficult subject interesting. You can laugh at aspects of it. Certainly there is nothing funny about sexual violence. However, when you take something like the Vagina Monologues that looks at a range of experiences that women and girls share, some of them are quite funny. And so you can incorporate those in along with serious messages. And frankly, you will reach a wider audience. Who wants to go to a lecture on sexual violence?
Yeah, and who wants to go to be depressed and demoralized.
Exactly. And so entertainment education offers, in my mind, not only positive messages interwoven with, you know, some facts that may be difficult to hear, but also some ways out, some actual pathways to take action if one were to choose to do so.
So you studied the Vagina Monologues not as a work of art, but as a way of how it affected people's lives.
How you can use art to affect people's lives. And the effects were really tremendous, both for the people that were in the monologues and for the men and women that witnessed them, whether they were survivors of sexual violence, which many of them were, or whether they had never experienced it.
Now, for people who haven't seen the Vagina Monologues and who aren't familiar with that whole artwork, and it's an unusual play in the way it was put out and the way it's been performed over many years. Explain a little bit about what this whole thing is.
The Vagina Monologues was written and is often performed by an artist named Eve Ensler, and it's been around for, I think, about 11 years now. The play consists of 12 monologues about the experiences of women and girls and the people that love them, and men and boys. And four of those 12 monologues are very explicitly deal with violence against women and girls. The play forms the foundation for a larger movement called the V-Day movement, which is to end violence against women and girls globally. And for anyone who's interested, the play is out on DVD. They can go to vday.org to learn more. But basically, to answer your question, the play consists of 12 monologues.
And the thing that was so interesting about it is, I mean, Eve Ensler interviewed a lot of people in order to write this play in the first place. So these are real stories with, of course, the hand of the artist affecting the exact monologues. But since she first performed it, it has then been let go into innumerable communities. Mm-hmm. And there are many different ways of performing it. Sometimes it's one artist, one performer doing it. Sometimes it's 10.
Right. And that, to me, is very exciting because it opens up a lot of possibilities for involvement. And so in the communities in which I studied the Vagina Monologues and their effect, it was two New Jersey communities where they had people, local community members, perform a monologue in the play. So you had 12 different women in each community who stood up on stage, who were not professional actors or anything, who perform this for their community.
And so what was the effect? Let's start with the people who performed it.
If I may, I'd like to read you a quote from the book. It's one of my favorites.
This is your book called Art, Violence, and Social Change.
Yes, and the quote is, "We weren't crying, we were laughing, rejoicing in the fact that we lived through what we lived through and we were able to share it with other women. Being in the Vagina Monologues kind of brought it around. I'm not afraid to say I'm a survivor. Being involved in this makes you able to stand up and say, this is what happened, this is what's happening, and we need to do something about it." This is from a young woman I interviewed. She was 21 at the time I interviewed her, and she had been sexually assaulted by her brother at age 17. So in the process of dealing with the aftermath of sexual violence, her entire family was ripped apart by this incident. And one of the things that she found...
Meaning raped?
Yes, she was raped by her brother. And so she was able to find a community of women many of whom had gone through this experience. She found it very healing and powerful to be in the Vagina Monologues, and it gave her a place to stand up when she chose to talk about this and what needs to change.
So that was one example of a performer whose life was deeply affected and probably changed by it. I don't know how much follow-up you did after all of this research, but what about the audience members?
I was really moved. I cried. I thought about my sister, you know, being abused. Just kind of sat back. And I mean, when I was there, I was actually trying to just think what it would be like. Like looking through this woman's eyes and seeing someone come after you.
Now, whose words are those?
Those are the words of a male audience member whose sister had been a victim of domestic violence. And he was completely overcome by what he saw on stage. And he was really able to he's talking about putting himself in the shoes of the characters up on the stage. And if you can think about that, is very powerful to take someone who's never had the experience and help them be able to try to really see what that experience would be like. That's a powerful motivation to be involved in social change.
I suppose you could probably say that at the root of all social change is that ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and start thinking about things differently because of that experience.
Absolutely, to broaden your own vision of what possibilities are and what happens, good and bad, and be willing and motivated to do something about it. And one of the things that came out of the research is the role that affect plays in learning.
Affect meaning?
Emotional response. You know, we tend to have sort of a dry pedagogical take on education in this culture, and it tends to be more lecture-based. I think that's changing, but even when I taught at the University at Rutgers, we tended to go into the classroom and lecture at people. I think when we can really involve them and involve more of their senses, their intellect, but also their emotion, we actually get a lot farther. And those are things that we need to do on issues like this.
And one of the things that I've noticed in myself and in others, both as an adult and as a school child, is when you're anxious or scared, you can't learn anything.
Exactly. If I may, I'd like to read one more quote from a young woman who really had such a horrible experience growing up and who was so resilient and powerful. I was raped from 4 to 11 by my stepfather. I looked around the room at the...
Wait a minute, 4 to 11.
Age 4 to 11.
Okay.
I was raped from age 4 to 11 by my stepfather. I looked around the room at the Vagina Monologues and I'm like, statistically speaking, there's at least another 40 women in this room alone who have gone through the same thing I have. There's not like a brand on somebody that you could pick out. What used to be so secretive was brought out in the open at the Vagina Monologues. I found that very liberating. We don't have a lot of voice and a lot of language for the experience of sexual violence in our culture, which is so sad. Just because it's a devastating experience, but also given the prevalence rates.
Yeah, it's such a common experience.
Exactly, and yet it's so hidden. And so our survivors are very hidden, and there aren't a lot of avenues for them to speak up about it. This really provided an avenue, whether you were in the audience or you were performing it, to come together with other people and talk about it in a way that each individual survivor chose to.
We're talking to Karen Herman. She is Director of Sexual Assault Services for New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs. One thing that I would like you to explain, if you can, is let's say you're walking down the street and somebody hits you and takes your wallet. You're furious. Let's say you're walking down the street and somebody rapes you. You have experienced shame. This is a common thing. You don't experience shame when someone steals your wallet, but you experience shame when somebody rapes you. What's going on?
We as a culture still tend to blame victims of sexual violence. And I can tell you, Mary Charlotte, in my work with victims, my direct clinical work, every single person that I've ever worked with, men and women, and it's important to acknowledge that men and boys are very much victims of sexual violence, even though we consider it to be a women's issue. Every person that's experienced it blames themselves at some point. And that's just a tremendous cultural baggage that we have around sexual violence and the shame associated with it, and not being able to talk about it openly and why it happens and how the person who commits sexual violence is always the person that is responsible for it. It's not ever the victim's fault. We've come far in that, but still you'd be surprised at some of the victim-blaming attitudes that are out there. So when people are bombarded with that message all the time, they certainly internalize it.
And it's even true of young children.
Absolutely. And I think one of the issues around that is that we have a myth in our culture, and again, we've come far with this, is that sexual violence is committed by someone who jumps out of the bushes and attacks you, and it's someone who's unknown. And certainly in the situation you just described, being mugged and having your wallet taken, generally speaking, it's going to be a stranger who mugs you. Sexual violence is overwhelmingly committed in our culture by someone known to the victim. That leads for all kinds of questioning about what was the nature of the relationship and what did this person do to, quote unquote, bring this on themselves and all of that. So that's one of the things that we need people to understand. It's not an incident of rape because you knew the person. That's a common misperception. If someone coerces sex on another person, that's sexual violence, whether they're known to the victim or not.
You spoke a few minutes ago about cultures that don't have rape and sexual assault. Ours has a very high prevalence of it. Can you identify what the cultural factors are about the way we live that leads to such high prevalence of sexual violence?
This is a huge question that's debated in many circles. In our culture, we've looked at feminist analyses in particular, which are the ones that I give the most playtime to in the book, look at both ideology and structure. In other words, ideology being our attitudes and beliefs about different genders, about women and girls and acceptable use of violence against them, and our social structures, meaning our social relationships, our legal, political, economic, educational institutions, religious institutions. When you look back through the history in the United States, there's been a tremendous amount of ideological support and structural support for violence against women and girls.
Specifically, what does that look like?
So, for example, the church, in some religions, some dominant religions, and I want to be clear that I'm not anti-religious, but it has stood up and said the sanctity of marriage overrides the need for women's safety, that it is your role to be subservient to your husband, whether there's violence or not. I mean, that's been clearly spoken in some major religions. You look at educational institutions. At times, women have not been permitted in many different kinds of programs, whether it be medical school or law school. So there's been very clear discrimination that's gone on over time that has both influenced ideology and been a product of ideology.
And staying with the church example for a moment, there's also so many examples in the Catholic Church of priests who are known to be abusing children to just be moved to a different parish.
Right. The issue was not taken seriously. The damage that it does was not understood.
What about the role of militarism? We have a highly militarized culture in comparison to almost really any other country in the world right now. We have a huge amount of military spending and military involvement and prevalence. I was flipping channels the other day and trying to find a movie to watch, and you know, had nothing to do in the afternoon, whatever. And it was hard to find one that didn't either have a murder or a military theme in it that wasn't just like super kitschy.
To have a militaristic culture, you have to say that violence is acceptable. And once you say that extreme forms of violence and a high prevalence rate of violence is acceptable, it's very hard to go back and then say, but we can't use it against our children, or we can't use it against women or boys or certain groups. So I think there's no question that the militarization of our culture has played into an acceptance of violence, and that plays out in private and public sectors.
And as we talked about with Dar Jamil last week, even when it's not considered acceptable, when you've got all these veterans coming home, for example, mm-hmm. with post-traumatic stress, they're going to act out in ways that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And post-traumatic stress has gotten a lot of attention in the last decade, and it's so needed. Because not only do soldiers certainly experience it, but survivors of sexual violence experience it as well.
Yeah, that's another, I think soldiers get a lot of attention, and they need way more attention, they need way more services, but so do all these women who have experienced these things and really compose a huge class of survivors who really don't have the camaraderie with each other that soldiers do.
There's no question, and in a sense, because we've so-called privatized sexual violence and we've made it such a shameful thing, it is very hard to come forward. It's not a shared camaraderie like I went to war with the other members of my platoon. And so one of the things that I thought was interesting about the Vagina Monologues is that it really put sexual violence out there in a way in the community that people could choose to engage with it and choose to share some camaraderie and develop some connections around it in a very positive way, in a very healing way. And I just wanted to say that for anyone who's experienced sexual violence, they need to know that there are services out there. The effects of sexual violence are very severe. Survivors who don't receive treatment are much more likely to attempt or commit suicide, much more likely to have physical as well as emotional health problems and substance abuse problems, as well as issues in their relationships, and sometimes difficulty in school or work or just functioning in our communities. And there is help available, and it's often free.
Now, you're the director of sexual assault services here in New Mexico, the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs. Tell us about that coalition and some of the services that you provide.
So the coalition was started about 25 years ago by a legislative mandate to address sexual violence in our communities and also try to reduce the prevalence rate of it. So currently we have 7 sexual assault specific providers throughout the state. And we also have sexual assault coordinators at every community mental health center in the state. So that means that we do have a lot of free services available to victims. The coalition also engages in a tremendous amount of training in communities in prevention work, a lot of training with organizations such as law enforcement, in schools, with teachers, CYFD, Children, Youth, and Families Department. So we really have tried to look at a lot of the facets of the needs around sexual violence and work towards addressing them. I can tell you, sadly, Mary Shaw, we are a very under-resourced state in terms of our funding. We do the absolute best that we can to stretch those dollars and reach into every corner of our state.
So, are you talking about, for example, organizations like the Santa Fe Rape Crisis Center?
I am. And if anyone was interested in contacting the center, the phone number is 988-1951. And if they needed help or wanted to get help for someone else for a different part of the state, they could call the coalition at 1-888-883-8020. That's toll-free.
So the 888 is toll-free. And then what's the number again?
It's 883-8020. Mm-hmm. And they could get information about a provider in their community.
So let's talk about New Mexico. When you look at this state, how are we doing in terms of violence against women?
We have very high rates of sexual violence here in New Mexico against women and children, both boys and girls. We have one of the highest rates in the nation. Currently, we actually gather very specific data for New Mexico. We're somewhat unique in that we have a researcher who's employed by the coalition who does a study every single year that's New Mexico specific to the incidence of sexual violence. Her name is Dr. Betty Caponara, and what she has found is that in our state, 1 in 5 women and 1 in 25 men will experience a completed sexual assault, meaning rape, in their lifetime.
Oh, boy.
A lot of those victims are under the age of 12. And again, we need to remember that this issue affects everyone. A lot of boys and men are affected by sexual violence. It is often very difficult for them to come forward.
Are you able to, as a sociologist and as a researcher yourself, understand what the roots of that are here in this state?
Here is my best guess. We haven't gone and done a methodologically rigorous study on why we think New Mexico has higher rates. So this is my take on things, as rudimentary as it may be. As a frontier state, we've experienced a lot of major social shifts and transitions in our short time, meaning, for example, first of all, the colonization of the state by Spanish, and then the colonization of the state by Anglos, and the cultural genocide that has gone along with that against different groups over time.
Not to mention the physical genocide.
Exactly, exactly. So I think those two factors do play a role in this. I think part of the other issue that we definitely struggle with being a frontier state is funding comes to each state from the Centers for Disease Control, and it's based on population numbers. We have a huge state and smaller population numbers, meaning our funding is quite low. However, that doesn't mean our need is lower, and we need funding to reach out into communities, rural communities. Because of that, we experience, first of all, difficulty in providing services in all areas of the state. We also experience a lot of problems with prosecution. We don't have the funding or sometimes the expertise, people do the best they can, to successfully prosecute sexual violence. So to be honest with you, Mary Shara, I've had providers say to me in some corners of the state that they feel that the message to perpetrators is that they will get away with sexual violence. So I'm not saying that's the cause. I mean, I think it's an effect, but I think it allows it to perpetuate in some ways.
Now, in the rural corners of the state, going back to what you said earlier about people who have a greater connection with the land and the cycles of nature and other species, mm-hmm. it's not doing the job? Or?
Well, we've really disrupted that. I mean, look at things such as the forced removal and schooling of indigenous children to boarding schools. We lost an entire generation of children who were forced out of their culture. Talk about cultural genocide as well as sometimes physical genocide. And I've had some indigenous people say to me, you know, you imported that into our culture. We didn't have sexual violence, and our children went to your boarding schools and they were abused and they came back. And so that is in no way to pathologize indigenous people. But, you know, that has been a significant experience for example, Native peoples in the West.
Now, switching gears entirely, or maybe not as much as all of that, you are also, Karen Herman, the founder and president of Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary, which is on the web at skymountainwild.org. And tell us about that work.
So the sanctuary came to be, honestly, Mary Charlotte, in a moment of temporary insanity, for which I'm now very grateful. I wanted to do some kind of sanctuary for animals and a place where in the future children could come and be outside and experience wildlife and just have a good time and be connected to nature. And that is very much, as we talked about, in line with rape-free cultures where they have a connection to other species and a connection to the natural world and natural cycles. So I sort of had that in the back of my mind for quite a while now, having done this work for a long time. And in 2007, I saw four Mustangs who were standing in a holding corral. They had been rounded up from the Carson National Forest. They were in extremely poor condition, and they were up for adoption. And what happens with wild horses in the West is that when they're rounded up, they are offered for adoption. And if they're not adopted after three times, or if they're already over the age of 10, they can go to slaughter. And so looking at the condition of these Mustangs, I felt that their future options were very limited. And I just wanted to do something about it. So I adopted the four of them. One was pregnant. And so now we have five Mustangs at the sanctuary. So that's how it came into being.
How did you get together the land for the sanctuary?
Through a lot of luck and hard work, I was looking for a place to lease and stumbled on a man who has a family ranch in northern New Mexico. He does not live there and is not able to keep up the fence and monitor things up there the way he would like to. And so in exchange for my keeping up the fence and taking care of the horses, we lease that from him. We do a work exchange.
So let's talk for a moment about the history of wild horses here in the West, here in New Mexico. There was a great problem with the killing of wild horses for a long time until a law was passed in the 70s.
In 1971, the Wild Horse and Free Roaming Burro Act, Protection Act, was passed in response to extreme cruelty, shootings, poisonings of wild horses, they would starve them out or fence off water supplies so that horses would die sort of a long, painful death. They were seen as a nuisance by many on the range.
Nuisance to whom?
A nuisance to other wildlife and those who were looking to graze privately on livestock on public lands. So the legislation was passed in 1971, which afforded a lot of protection for wild horses. There were some issues with implementation in that the agency that was previously in charge of eradicating wild horses, the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, was then put in charge of protecting them. So there have been some ideological issues with that.
Right. I can't imagine that the people who were in charge of eradicating them weren't going to suddenly change their minds and say, these are our friends. And in fact, the numbers of wild horses still went way down. I mean, they were decimated since that law was passed.
Correct. Here in New Mexico, in 1972, they did a report to Congress, and they estimated, now again, it's an estimate. Wild horses don't stand still for counting. They estimated that our population here in this state was between 6,000 and 7,000 wild horses. We now estimate our population at between 600 and 700.
Yeah, so literally decimated. There's 110 left.
Right. We had 8 federally designated wild horse territories that were identified by the protective legislation when it was passed. The populations of 5, here in New Mexico, the populations of 5 of those wild horse territories have been zeroed out. And so now we have 3 functioning wild horse territories left, and our horses came from one of those.
Now, when you say zeroed out, what do you mean?
Removed. And I can't tell you, it happened a long time ago, so I don't know if they were killed. How they were removed, my guess is a combination of roundups and probably some killing.
And there were also, I mean, that act that you just mentioned contained wild burros.
Correct. And we had, our wild burros were zeroed out in our state quite a while ago. We no longer have any burros left in New Mexico.
So you started this wild horse sanctuary. What is your vision for this sanctuary?
So the mission is to provide permanent refuge for wild horses that enable them to stay free and wild throughout their lifetime. In other words, we don't train them or ride them or try to make them do anything. They simply stay wild. The second part of our mission is through research and education and action. We seek to promote the humane treatment of all wild horses, protection of their habitat, and a further understanding about wild horses in our environment. Wild horses have been blamed for a lot of things, Mary Charlotte, for destruction of water sources and grass and the environment. And it's not to say certainly when they graze, they are eating food that other wildlife could be grazing on. But we have, we think, about 30,000 wild horses left in the entire western United States versus millions of privately owned livestock on public lands competing for grass as well. And I want to be clear, I'm not anti-livestock and I'm not anti-rancher. I'm just saying we are for balance at Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary, and that to me is not balance.
When you talk about the attitude toward horses in the past, it reminds me sort of the attitude toward wolves now, demonizing them.
And, you know, wolves, now we know, they play a very important part in the ecosystem. They save, you know, riparian areas because elk don't gather around them and trample down all of the areas around water sources when wolves keep them on the move. You know, they have a tremendous role to play in a balanced ecosystem. And one of the arguments against wild horses, Mary Charlotte, has been that they're not native, that they were extinct and they died out and they were reintroduced by the Spanish, and therefore they're a so-called nuisance animal. And there's a couple caveats to that. First of all, from a biological perspective, they are the genetic equivalent of the native wild horses that were on the North American continent. They are a native species. And the other thing is, there's actually some debate now about whether, in fact, they ever died out in North America. Some indigenous people will tell you that we've always had wild horses here. So that's a sort of a debated argument. But certainly, we feel it at Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary, as a wildlife species, they have a place to play in a balanced ecosystem. And then the key word there is balance.
So are you looking for example, more land, more horses?
Here's our 3 top action items for the sanctuary. First of all, we would love to take in more horses. So we are fundraising for that, and we do need to expand in terms of our land mass. We will not take in more horses at the expense of the health of the land that they run on. So, you know, we welcome visitors to our website. We welcome new members and anyone who may be interested in helping with those efforts. So we're looking to expand personally and provide a permanent home to more so-called homeless Mustangs. That's number one. The second thing is that we are looking to help control the root of the problem, which is reproduction with wild horses. We've taken away a lot of their native predators. We've also taken away a lot of their landmass. So to simply say that we have too many wild horses in the West is not the full argument. We continue to take away the land that was set aside for them, as we see in New Mexico, down to 3 territories from 8.
What happened to those other 5 territories?
As I said, the populations were zeroed out, and they're now used for, you know, livestock grazing and other wildlife species.
So, I mean, horses by right, if they had an advocate, couldn't go back there?
That is my hope. I can tell you that is an uphill battle. But one of the things we would love to see at Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary is a return to wild horses of some of the land that was set aside for them originally. And I can tell you that's a nationwide trend. That's not a western-wide trend. That's not just something that happened in New Mexico. I think it's about a third of land allotted in wild horse territories across the West has since been taken away from the horses. So it's not just a question of too many. Here in New Mexico, given the realities of a high desert ecosystem, you know, drought that happens somewhat regularly, and the fact that the horses don't have a lot of landmass to run on anymore, one of the things we've become involved in at Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary is wild horse birth control. So what we're looking to do is eliminate the need for rounding up wild horses and removing them from the wild, which to me, given that they're a wild animal, is cruel. And looking to manage their population in the wild through immunocontraceptive so that we can keep their population stable to what the land can actually hold, and keep the land healthy and keep the horses healthy and not have to have them removed. Really, if you think about it, given current technology, we've had this roundup and removal mentality for 100 years, and it's time to innovate. It's time for a new solution. We don't have to just take animals out of the wild all the time.
So you're not talking about neutering or spaying every horse, just a few of them, or what? How does it work?
No. Porcine zona pellucida is, or PZP, is an immunocontraceptive. It's actually fascinating to me, even though I'm a social scientist, not a biological science, because of the way it works. It actually doesn't change hormone systems or social behavior. It's been proven safe in horses over 20 years of use.
So they mate and don't get pregnant.
Exactly. It's an immunocontraceptive that simply prevents conception.
So the idea is to use it on some percentage of female horses?
Exactly. And what we're looking to do here in New Mexico, we're very excited about, is immunizing our youngest fillies so that they delay reproduction and they get healthier and stronger by the time they have their first foal. And then immunizing our oldest mares so that they're not constantly worn down by foaling every year. And then leaving some mares in the age range of maybe 4 to 8 who reproduce for several years in a row and then are treated with the contraceptive.
So when you use this contraceptive, it doesn't last forever.
Which is great. It's actually reversible, so we can use it on young fillies and then leave them alone and then they can breed. And if we were to experience some catastrophe such as a drought or some kind of illness in the herd, no one has been permanently contracepted.
It actually, I have to say, it sounds kind of like what we, many of us women do, which is try not to have teenage pregnancy and then when we're done having kids, try not to have any more.
Exactly, except unfortunately a lot of our choices are hormonally based, and so they really change our hormonal systems in ways that sometimes can be detrimental, and PZP does not do that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We're talking to Karen Herman, who is the director of the Sexual Assault Services in the state of New Mexico and the founder and president of Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary. So what is the connection between these two parts of your life, if I may ask?
Well, first of all, the sanctuary is just a huge joy in my life. And it's also something that sustains me in my work in the field of sexual violence, which is very important to me and very meaningful to me and can be very difficult. I've been in the field over half my life. And so I've met incredible people who are doing amazing work. I've worked with very resilient survivors. I'm amazed by how far we've come and some of the amazing people that we have working in the field. It's also very difficult. And so there's that connection. And as I was saying before, my hope with the sanctuary in the long term, we are a startup, we're only 2 years old, is to have a place where children in particular, but adults as well, can come and experience the outdoors, experience a connection to wild horses and wildlife, and start to build some of those protective factors that we've identified in other cultures that are rape-free cultures. We're particularly interested in having so-called at-risk kids, maybe children who've been in foster care or who've already had experience of violence, have the chance to come out and have some fun, be in a camp environment, enjoy themselves, and just be out in nature.
There is something, and of course it's not the same as riding horses and taking care of horses, because you don't do that with wild horses, but there is something about getting to know horses which is profound.
Very powerful for people. And the other thing is that animals accept us in a way that humans don't. And that, especially for children, is very powerful.
Karen, tell us more about PZP. I mean, I'm assuming it's not available for human beings. I never heard of it before.
I do get asked the question if I'm available to dart certain humans. Often, actually. So I do say no. So the first use of PZP in New Mexico, and actually in the nation by a Forest Service, occurred with our project in March of 2009 last year. Sky Mountain is one-third of the PZP team in New Mexico. I'm on the team. Dan Elkins, who's the contractor for the Forest Service who rounds up the horses, is on the team, as well as Anthony Madrid, who's the wild horse coordinator for the Carson National Forest. So we were able to get some external funding to start this project 3 years ahead of schedule, and we're very excited about it. So we treated horses in March of 2009, and then Dan and I actually worked on the logistics to treat them remotely in the wild, and we started treating them in October of this year out in the wild. So in other words, they don't have to be captured in any kind of way. We're remote darting them with air rifles. So it's a very exciting project, and our goal is within the next 3 years to move to PZP only and not have to remove any more horses from the Carson.
Now, is this a controversial thing? Are there people who are against any kind of birth control for wild horses?
There are. There are some people that think that starvation is actually a more humane end than managing populations through any kind of so-called intervention, like is birth control. I can tell you that having seen horses that are starving, I don't agree. There have been questions raised about the safety and the efficacy of PZP. And I've looked at, there's 20 years of research data out on it. It's been used by the National Park Service out in the east on wild ponies on Assateague Island for 20 years. And they've had no adverse health effects, no problems with it whatsoever. So generally speaking, what's happened is people who don't have all the information sometimes will come out against it.
Karen, if people would like to get more involved or learn more about the different activities that you're doing, what roles could they play and how could they get in touch with you?
First of all, if anyone could give a home to a wild horse, who, you know, people are welcome to adopt. You need to educate yourself about what you're getting into.
Now, a wild horse? I mean, I assume that they are social animals. You'd need to have more than one?
I think that would be the ideal, Mary Charlotte. Many people often will adopt one and maybe have domestic horses or that kind of thing. Certainly, horses are band animals. They live in family bands. They're very familial oriented and have strong social bonds. So it's, in my opinion, it's always best for a horse to have other horses around. So people could be involved by adopting a wild horse that would otherwise go to a BLM holding facility or to auction for slaughter. If they had an interest in doing that, they can go to the website for the Carson National Forest, and there's information there on how to adopt wild horses. Certainly, they're welcome to go to our website at Sky Mountain Wild.
SkyMountainWild.org.
Right, and learn more about what we're doing and become a member, or if they had some land that they might explore having some horses on, we can look at those kinds of possibilities. And certainly if people are interested in their own communities about learning more about sexual violence and how to prevent it, how to address it, they could contact the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, find their closest provider in their community, and become involved in supporting that organization. We have amazing rape crisis providers in our state. They usually have volunteer opportunities available. A lot of them are fun. It's not all, you know, negative and horrifying and all of that. And we certainly welcome contributions and volunteers to help us move our work forward.
And people can call 888-883-8020 to find out more about the the whole sexual violence aspect. And once again, skymountainwild.org for the horse sanctuary. Karen Herman is Director of Sexual Assault Services for the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs. And she is founder and president of Sky Mountain Wild Horse Sanctuary. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Shard. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find me at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.